Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey, Mondays at 4 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, some of the foreigners that now rule Haiti are talking about sending yet another Haitian president into exile. And a new book examines how the U.S. Supreme Court methodically stripped black people of their civil and constitutional rights.
But first, President Obama was more friendly than ever to corporate America in his State of the Union speech. We spoke with Richard Wolff, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and author of the book, Capitalism Hits the Fan, The Global Economic Meltdown and What to Do About It. Professor Wolff was most struck by what Obama did not talk about last week.
Let me start with what is perhaps the most profound issue that I found absent. Over the last 25 years, and ironically even more during the crisis of the last four, the inequality in the distribution of wealth and income in the United States has gotten markedly greater. I mean, really dramatic. You don't see in most societies in comparable short periods of historical time anything like this kind of change, and particularly not this kind of change in the direction of greater inequality. Before the crisis hit, this had to do with the fact that the real wages of American workers were flat for 25 years, while the productivity, what they delivered to their employers, kept rising. In the last 4 years, it's been the crisis itself. And there the crucial things have been, of course, the rising unemployment, the foreclosures wiping out large numbers of people's investment in their homes, and then the collapse of home prices, since the only wealth most Americans have, if they have any, is their home. So if that goes down in price, you are really sticking it to the average person. I would have thought that a speech entitled The State of the Union would have had something to say about what it means for a society to experience such a growing fundamental economic inequality, and then hopefully to have a president say something about what he or his administration might have in mind to do to, I assume, reverse this situation on the grounds that it is unjust and socially destabilizing. I didn't hear a word. I mean, literally, not a word, not even obliquely, not even indirectly about that. So I found that to be a sign that the kinds of policies that could be justified by being targeted to do something about that inequality are simply off the mentality, off the agenda, off the list of anything that anyone down there in Washington has in mind. The second thing is the crisis of cities and states. When you have a crisis in the economy like this, and you throw millions of people out of work, and you mess up the housing market and all the rest, one of the first casualties is city and state government. They are not allowed to borrow money for their operating budgets the way the federal government is, so they're really dependent on the flow of taxes, income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, and so on. This kind of crisis, especially because it's so bad, and especially because it's lasted so long, is now producing unbelievable pressures on all 50 state governments and on all the towns and cities across the country. They have much less revenue than they've had before, and they're going to have to do something. They're either going to have to raise taxes, which is very unpopular, or they're going to cut programs and public payrolls, which is unpopular, but not as much as taxes, given our strange culture. And that's what they're all doing. And you're cutting a vast support for the average person's life, whether it's public schools or public colleges and universities or fire departments or social workers or city health workers and on and on and on. And the amounts of money involved here, which go into the hundreds of billions, completely dwarf anything the president was talking about. Let me give you just one example. The race to the top, the amounts of money that are in the 2011 and 2012 likely budgets are $2, $3, $4 billion for the race to the top, and maybe even 5 to 10 if he's lucky and if the Republicans permit it. But that's nothing compared to the tens of billions that are being cut from public schools, public universities, by cities and states. So since there's nothing that the president said about helping city and states the way the first stimulus did, you're not quite, how shall I say this, honest to make a big hoop-de-doo in your State of the Union speech about your commitment to education, innovation, and all that, when in fact what you're doing is not helping cities and states whose actions overwhelm, on the negative side, anything positive you're even talking about, let alone could get through such a Congress. And the last, the third one, and then I'll stop, has to do with unemployment. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics in Washington, 10% of our people are unemployed, full-time, out of work, looking for work, not finding it. Another 7%, on top of that 10%, are in two other categories: people with a part-time job but who want a full-time, and people who used to be called, quote-unquote, discouraged workers. They're now called marginalized workers, but those are the people who've been unemployed and have stopped looking. So if you add them all together, it's over 17%, one out of six Americans. The State of the Union is deeply affected by this fact about the State of the Union, and the president had nothing to say. He didn't talk to those people. He didn't offer anything. And let me be real precise. What he did say was that he's going to stimulate or encourage or support corporations, cutting their corporate profits tax and various other things to hopefully stimulate them to hire people. That's the closest he came to talking about unemployment. Well, that's a disaster. For the last 3 years, that's been the program, first of Bush, then of Obama, to stimulate the private sector in the hopes, to use the old phrase, it'll trickle down. Well, he stimulated them, but it never trickled, as it usually does not. And so to promise us more of the stimulation of corporate America in the hopes it'll trickle down, when the last 2 or 3 years have been a dismal failure, unless he gives us some reason to believe the next spate of helping the corporations will trickle down, whereas the others didn't, there's no reason to do this. And he offered not one shred of reason to believe in it. His predecessor, in a time of roughly comparable crisis, Franklin Roosevelt in the great 30s, depression, went on the radio in 1933, 34, I don't remember the exact date, and he basically said on that radio program, if the private sector either cannot or will not hire Americans, then there is no alternative but to have the government do it. From 1934 to 1941, the Roosevelt administration created 11 million federal jobs. Why in the world could this president today, Obama, not at the least have said to the American people, we need to debate the pros and cons of such a response? It worked. At least it helped a lot in the 1930s. It should at least, if not passed, at least be debated by the American people as one of the solutions to consider. He didn't do that. You know, as an economist, which is what I do for a living, there's never been one shred of evidence to believe that economic policy can effectively trickle down. To put it another way, it's just as reasonable to expect economic policy to trickle up. That is, give people jobs, pay them a decent income on a mass basis, and then hope that the corporations will get the benefit as people can buy things, as people can enjoy their incomes and buy the objects that corporations produce. Even if it doesn't work to trickle up, you will at least have helped a lot of people. By going with a trickle-down program, which is what Obama announced, in effect, both by what he said and what he didn't say, he's basically staying with the same old, and there's no reason to believe it's going to work any better over the next 2 years than it did over the first two. So, I mean, I don't mean to be a downer, but I was sorely disappointed by all that was not said and what it means.
And we should say that the 11 million jobs created, federal jobs created during the Great Depression, occurred in a country with less than half the population that we have now, would be the equivalent of about 25 million federally created jobs today.
That's right. And by the way, in the economics community that I circulate in, you know, mostly academic economists, 25 million is the rough number we use in talking about the effective number of our people in the United States who are now unemployed or underemployed. So yes, it was Roosevelt's attempts, by the way, not altogether successful, but certainly Roosevelt became the greatest hero any president in modern times has been because he gave so many millions of people a break, a chance to work, a decent income at a time when they were miserable after 3 or 4 years of depression and looking down the barrel of many more years. So you wonder why, even if I can be more venal for a moment, even why as a political calculator hoping for re-election in 2 years, it didn't seem to make any imprint on Obama and his advisors to try at least a little to be the kind of hero that actually helps people that Roosevelt was. You know, Roosevelt was reelected 4 times. They had to pass that law that nobody could be president more than twice in reaction to his unbelievable popularity, and nobody in their right mind would doubt that one of the keys to that was the mass hiring program that he adopted in the depths of the Depression.
No, it doesn't seem to be explainable unless one assumes that Obama is actually ideologically committed to this kind of corporate politics.
Well, it's hard. I mean, you know, I don't know him. I don't know very much about him beyond, you know, the little bit I read in the papers, and who knows whether that's reliable. But the last few weeks, whether it's giving up on the taxing of the tax extension for the rich, whether it's naming Daley and Jeffrey Immelt as major advisors. I mean, it's not a pretty picture for people who want there to be a change of policy. Frankly, for me, I teach economic history, so I look at the intersection of economics and history a bit. For me, it is a very sad kind of capitulation, at least so it seems to me, of what I had thought might be a bit of a questioning of the dominance of the corporations. I'm stunned, to tell you the truth. If you look at the Great Depression in the United States, it was a time when business did, at least in part, take it on the chin. The Roosevelt administration must have gotten real scared that capitalism as a whole was in trouble, and they were prepared to make the business community and the rich really pay. And the distribution of wealth and income became much less unequal across the 1930s. People don't know that, but it did. But that's not happening with this crisis. The corporate sector is in such command that even though it brought on the crisis, it is using the crisis to advance the same agenda that got us to the crisis. So you sit there as an economic historian shaking your heads in awe at their capacity, underscored by this State of the Union message, to keep such a control in their own interest. You know, we made a big deal 2 years ago about the concept too big to fail. You know, the Citibank and the other ones were too big to fail. Well, we've now merged the company, the banks that were too big to fail, so they're even bigger than they were then. And nothing happens. You know, you just watch this process unfold. We know, and that report that was released today amplifies it, that Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and Fitch, the three major agencies in this country that rate the riskiness of securities, systematically underestimated the risk of all the securities that eventually went bust, and nothing happens. We continue to think Warren Buffett is some great guru that God has blessed us with, and we conveniently forget that Warren Buffett owns Berkshire Hathaway, which owns Moody's, which is the culprit on the line for this kind of stuff. I find these signs of an extraordinary ability of the corporate sector to come out ahead in the crisis almost as much as they did before it hit. This is the second major collapse of capitalism in 75 years, the last one in the Great Depression of the 30s. Between the end of that depression, roughly 1939 or 40, and the onset of the current one in 2007, we count as an economics profession 11 downturns, some of which, like the one in the mid-70s, was quite severe. You know, I make a joke when I teach my classes. If you lived with a roommate as unstable as capitalism, you long ago would have moved out or demand the roommate get professional help. But we live with a system whose instabilities are much more damaging than that of any roommate, and we don't do anything. We think it's somehow like the rain that falls occasionally. You have to live with it rather than demanding some kind of an adjustment. My feeling is, financial sector does what it does, but I can show you, if we had the time for a conversation, that the non-financial sectors, manufacturing, services, they did their part to produce this crisis too. You know, even the mass of people who took mortgages that they couldn't, that's part of trying to achieve the American dream. That's partly a result of advertising. That's partly a result of credit structures. You know, this is a system that produces these outcomes. And if we don't have the courage as a nation to debate the system, if we're going to stay with the old Cold War mentality, that talking about capitalism and asking the question that any society ought to ask, whether the economic system they have is the one that they need or the one they can do better than, then we're going to be stuck with, even, you know, if we arrested all the miscreants, the bad bankers, the bad risk evaluators, the ones that will be the heads of those companies coming after them, they're going to all do the same thing for all the same reasons. And I think this is a question that puts on the agenda for the American people the question of capitalism. And if they can't deal with it, if it's still too taboo, if we still have to pussyfoot around it, okay, then we won't deal with the system, but we're going to then deal with simply the symptoms, and we're not going to solve the problem.
So, in his State of the Union address, Obama had nothing for the jobless, he had nothing for the cities and the states, but he did propose a 5-year freeze on domestic discretionary expenditures, thus stripping down the government's ability to respond to the crisis.
Yes, it's amazing. You know, the first rule you teach in any macroeconomics curriculum in the United States, even those that are dominated by the Milton Friedman type mentality, the first rule you say is when you have a depression, large numbers of people out of work, companies not working at full tilt and all the rest, is that you don't cut consumer spending, because that drives the economy, especially one as consumer focused as ours. If we allow the federal government to cut back its spending, number one, on its own employees, at the same time that cities and states are cutting back, then not only are we not increasing the spending to get us out of the crisis, we're actually making it worse. Ditto the unemployment that is coming from public workers. I mean, this is bizarre. This is the kind of mistake in understanding what's needed that we have seen undermine recoveries in our own economy and in those of many other countries. And the power of right-wing ideology to be so terrified of a strong government that that we want to eviscerate it, to make it cut back, rather than deal with the question, gee, here's an alternative how to deal with the deficits that we claim to be so worried about. If you don't want the government to be in debt, then let the government tax the wealth of the United States. Let them tax the rich people and the big corporations who've done the best over the last 30 years. That's why we have growing inequality. Who've been helped by the government's program in this crisis more than everybody else, and who have the greatest ability to pay. Why the hell don't you go after them, raise the money, then you don't have the deficit, and therefore don't require to do the cutbacks that are counterproductive in a crisis? This is not rocket science, but it is something corporations and rich people don't want to hear about, so it's off the agenda. And now with Obama's kind of underscoring that he's okay with keeping all that off the agenda, as if the only issue is how you cut spending rather than who you're taxing, or better yet, who you're not taxing and ought to have. I'll give you one just simple example. If we went back in the United States to the same level of income tax brackets that we had, say, in 1980, Just reconstitute them. I don't not raise them above that. Just that, we would get rid of most of the deficit in the United States. And we had plenty of very rich people back then. And if we restored that level of taxation, those richest people in America would still be the richest people in America. They would have just been required to go back to what they used to pay, and in that way make a contribution proportional to their assets to solving a crisis they have rather a lot of responsibility for bringing. Why our president could not say that, I do not, and I really mean this, I do not understand. I voted for the guy. I voted for the guy with some enthusiasm. I look at it and I am, what's the word I should say? Disappointed is the nicest way I could put it.
That was Professor Richard Wolff.
The foreign powers that occupy and dominate Haiti are insisting that the Haitian government reverse the official results of November's chaotic presidential election. The Organization of American States, backed by the U.S. and France, is demanding that singer Sweet Mickey Martelly be declared the number two vote-getter. That would push Jude Celestin, President René Préval's favorite candidate, out of the planned election runoff. Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington says the pressures on Haiti's government are intense.
There have been very strong statements from a number of governments, and in particular the governments of the U.S., of France, and of Canada, who have often been involved in Haiti's political affairs in the past. And those strong statements have been accompanied by already some actions. One of those actions has been the U.S. administration's decision to revoke the visas of 12 leaders of the Unité Party, party of President Préval, in an effort to get them to change their minds and to withdraw the candidacy of their candidate, Jude Celestin. And in fact, an announcement has been made, yesterday was made, that they had decided to withdraw that candidacy following all of the international pressure. However, it should be noted that Jude Celestin, the candidate himself, has not confirmed that he is withdrawing his candidacy.
And in fact, we have heard that an OAS official was overheard suggesting that Préval be put on a plane and taken out of the country.
That's correct. So it's really a sad trend that we see repeating itself, or certainly an attempt to see that trend repeated on the part of these three powers. And yes, a conversation did take place within the interim commission, which is the commission that is in charge of distributing some of the main funding coming from the donor countries to different projects in Haiti. And although Haiti is nominally present on that committee, there have been many complaints that Haitians have, in fact, been bypassed in a lot of the decision-making. In this case, there's a conversation that's been related by the former representative of the Organization of American States, who made a very angry interview not long ago relating the incident, where shortly after the November 28 elections, there was a conversation about finding a plane in order to get President Préval out of the country, supposedly for his security. But again, we've seen a precedent of this sort of thing. Back in 2004, President Aristide was also removed, supposedly for security reasons, and he has not been able to return to Haiti since. He is in South Africa and trying to return to Haiti.
Of course, the ultimate pressure, since Haiti has already been invaded and occupied, is to cause foreign earthquake aid to be withdrawn.
That's right, and that is, in fact, one of the threats that's been made by one of the U.S.'s top diplomats, Susan Rice, ambassador to the United Nations, who just last week said precisely that if the recommendation made by the OAS verification mission, again, a recommendation that's based on a very flimsy methodology employed by the OAS verification mission, if that recommendation is not respected by the Préval government, she suggested that aid to Haiti could be cut.
Now, isn't that an amazing threat? Haiti is not just a normal poor country. It's a country that's just suffered an earthquake that killed possibly 300,000 people.
It will result in a great deal more problems for Haiti, and they're already obviously overwhelmed by the extent of the difficulties. And we're seeing a situation in Haiti where really there's been no improvement in the lives of Haitians that have been victims of the earthquake, who've lost their homes and so on, 1 year after the earthquake has occurred. So vital aid has not really reached them in a substantive way. And for aid to be cut on top of this would have catastrophic results.
Now, we've been talking about the election as if it were a normal election, but in fact, as you point out, the turnout in this election was the lowest for any presidential election in the Western Hemisphere, in both continents, in 60 years.
That's correct, and I think, you know, one also has to note that in Haiti, traditionally, there is a high voter turnout in elections. There has been in the past. The 2000 elections had a 65% turnout. In those elections, they were not presidential elections. They were merely legislative elections. And in the 2006 elections brought Préval to power, there was a nearly 60% turnout. Whereas in these elections of November 28th, we saw less than a 25% turnout. Very low participation that really was the result of a few things, but one of the main factors was, of course, the exclusion of Haiti's most popular party, FAMI-LAVALAS. It would be as if the Democratic Party were not to be allowed to participate in elections in the U.S.
What you would like to see would be a full recount of these November 28th elections, correct?
Well, I think it's more than us, really. It's I think nearly all of the Haitians that we've spoken to, more than a recount as well, redoing the elections entirely. So not just recounting the results of these elections where there was very weak participation, but holding new elections under a new reformed electoral authority. The current electoral authority inspires a great deal of distrust. He's taken very arbitrary political measures, such as the exclusion of Samuel Avalas. And in order to guarantee real participation, there needs to be trust in the electoral authorities. So that's really a precondition to having cleaner elections. And cleaner elections are a precondition to having elections with a high turnout and that guarantee a real legitimate government as an outcome.
So you want a redo, and yet the powers that be, and those powers are the Troika of France, Canada, and the United States, can't even accept the results of the election that they imposed on Haiti.
That's correct, and there is sort of a bitter irony to this, to the extent that these countries provided really the bulk of the funding for these elections, were very involved in the organization of the elections, and pushed very hard for them to occur despite all of the challenges that existed for these elections to occur on November 28th. And now they're not happy with the result, and they wish to change the result. And that's what we're seeing now, and they're applying a great deal of pressure on, of course, an extremely weak government, an extremely weak governing political party, and it does appear that they will buckle under that pressure, as would be expected.
And how does the return of Jean-Claude Duvalier muddy these waters?
Well, I think really there are various theories as to his return, but I think one thing that it certainly indicates is that conditions were created for such a return. There's essentially sort of a political vacuum that is emerged from this political crisis, where you have a sense there is no leadership and where a former dictator can just walk into the country and not face immediate prosecution. He is now being faced with prosecution, but is, you know, living in a very fancy residence and appears to be entirely free to go where he likes. So essentially, Duvalier has returned and has not faced the consequences of the terrible crimes that he committed during the late 70s and early 80s.
Could you ever envision a situation in which former President Aristide could just land at the airport and walk out of it in Haiti?
Of course, this is the other ironic element to the current situation. A former dictator who is, of course, involved in grave human rights abuses in the past is able to return to Haiti without any difficulty. And President Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a democratically elected leader who was forced into exile in 2004 through a coup, has not been able to return to his country. And in fact, he just recently published a letter in which he repeated his desire to return to Haiti and implored the governments of Haiti and South Africa, and we can imagine the Troika also being behind the scenes in the decision for him to be able to return to his country.
Alex Main of the Center for Economic and Policy Research.
Sam Yet was one of Newsweek magazine's few black reporters during the heyday of the black freedom movement. But Yet's version of the story wasn't the one that Newsweek's editors wanted to hear. Black Agenda Report's Dr. Jared Ball has this commentary.
Samuel Yet died last week, and the choice he wrote of, a choice long ago reached by this country, is a choice we've still not caught up to. It is a choice of this nation to more or less discard an increasingly unnecessary black population, and a choice posed to that black population as to how to respond. Our range of acceptable responses seems to have dwindled since Yet wrote the book, and much of the bases upon which he developed his concerns seem to have only worsened. Having suffered heavy losses in the fight against the national will to discard its black population, we have accepted the choices often imposed on the defeated, the colonized. Yet was the first black Washington correspondent at Newsweek magazine, and author in 1971 of The Choice, The Issue of Black Survival in America, the book that got him fired from that position. He said he was compelled to write his book after witnessing an absence of change over the decade of struggle in the 1960s. He said that he could have kept his nice job had I been a nigger instead of black, a spy instead of a reporter, a tool instead of a man. I could have stayed at Newsweek indefinitely. Instead, Yett wrote in The Choice that at the dawn of the 1970s, the United States was simultaneously at war with the colonized colored people of Indochina and the colonized colored people of the United States. He referenced the then exploding numbers of black un- and underemployment and the statement made by the labor secretary that the nation was piling up a human scrap heap of surplus laborers. Yett concluded that black Americans are obsolete people. And since then, these rates of un- and underemployment have risen, while so many more of the black surplus are siphoned off into the prison industrial complex, the post-1970s big boom business, which scholar Lawrence Bobo also says is creating black internal colonies. It is no wonder, then, that the Economic Policy Institute report from 2008 concluded then that black America is in a permanent recession. And there are more painful similarities. Yett wrote in 1971 of the many preferred distractions liberals maintain to avoid an inward look at the treatment of the domestically colonized. He said that while it may have become more in vogue to focus on the environment, that it is blackness that is unsightly in America. He said that while others feel the war is a more pressing issue, that it remains racism whose arrogance of superiority demands economic and military exploitation as much here as abroad. And especially given the popularity over the last two decades of the television show and all its spin-offs, it is important that Yett pointed out for those who thought that law and order was of prime importance that the phrase is but a Nixonian euphemism for the total repression and possible extermination of those in the society who cry for justice where little justice can be found. Yett also pointed out the fact that black elected leadership means nothing in the face of a system whose choice has been made regarding black people. He said these officials are powerless, but that the fault was not with them, but the system itself. Even they knew, he said, that their elections were false hope that inspired an equally false confidence in the political system. But ultimately, Yett was clear, the nation had made a choice, and it was one that threatens the long-term survival of black people. And before we are too quick to run off to find solace in the heavily promulgated images of black success, let us remember what legal scholar and professor Derrick Bell said not too long ago. He equated the nation's public policies as having the equivalent impact of weekly, random selections of black people who would be taken to a secluded place and shot. Black suffering and the permanent worsening conditions we face are not an accident of fate or the result of uncorrectable patterns of black behavior. No, they are intentional. They are national policy. The nation has made its choice. We, however, seem to have also made ours. Our willingness to not break with convention, to not assume our own agenda, and to advocate and implement our own alternatives theoretically, practically, and with some degree of unison has resulted in our choice being to go along and hope for a brighter day. Let us heed the warning in his death that we did not during his life. The choice Samuel Yett wrote of was theirs, but now must become ours.
That was Dr. Jared Ball speaking from Washington, D.C.
Just in time for Black History Month, Lawrence Goldstone has a new book out on a shamefully anti-black period in the history of the U.S. Supreme Court. Goldstone's book is titled Inherently Unequal, The Betrayal of Equal Rights by the Supreme Court.
During the 40 years following the Civil War, the court was initially faced with three Reconstruction amendments, the 13th, which abolished slavery, the 14th, which guaranteed equal protection under the law for everyone, and the 15th, which guaranteed everyone the right to vote. These amendments were unpopular. They were rammed through Congress during Reconstruction by a group of radical Republicans who saw America's moral duty as protecting the 4 million newly freed slaves. The court, representing, sadly enough, public opinion, began to chip away at those guarantees other than in the 13th Amendment. They didn't reinstitute slavery, but they chipped away at equal protection, and they chipped away at the right to vote, until by 1903, virtually no black person in the South could vote, and there was no protection against the most horrible set of laws, and that slavery had more or less been reinstituted
both in terms of the social relations between blacks and whites and in terms of the employment relations between blacks and whites. What the court essentially did over 40 years was to write any guarantees and protections for black Americans out of those two amendments, the 14th and 15th. And it is a shameful episode in our history. And they did it through a series of decisions which were written in such a way that made it almost impossible to penetrate. But if you spend the time, it is clear that what the court was doing was deciding what the 14th Amendment meant, not because of any intent or not even because of the wording, but simply because of a popular reluctance in America to share accommodations, to share rights, to share government with black Americans. The fundamental question that I'm raising is whether or not it's possible to read the American Constitution and know with absolute precision, without question, what it means. Because what we have now is an entire conservative wing of the court, which has spawned the Tea Party movement and enabled conservative congressmen who say, we know what the Constitution means. Antonin Scalia is a member of a school called textualists. They say, we take the words of the Constitution and the generally accepted meaning of the term, of the words. But the problem is that the American Constitution is not only vaguely written, but it was intentionally vaguely written to give the government powers that weren't exactly explicit. So when you have a situation where someone says, I know what these words mean, and my meaning is the only meaning and nobody else knows, that is very questionable to me. Now, in the current context, people understand, they see the Scalias and the Roberts and the Alitos doing this kind of thing. But my book, which covers the years 1865 to 1903, show how justices on the court, while purporting also to know exactly what the Constitution meant, actually changed the meaning of the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, to deprive African Americans, freedmen, the newly freed slaves, of the rights that that amendment was specifically drawn to give them. So what I found in doing the book was that I was writing about an historical period, and I was also writing about today.
People who discuss the Constitution are always talking about the intent of the framers. You seem to be saying that the U.S. Supreme Court, after the Reconstruction Congress, misinterpreted purposefully the intent of the people who created the amendment, that is, the intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment.
I would say that the record supports that, yes. What happened was, in a series of cases that started in 1873, roughly, and went into the early 1900s, the court said, for example, that the 14th Amendment, which guaranteed equal protection of the laws and due process to all citizens, black or white, was actually only protecting people against the actions of a state. In other words, if the state of Mississippi drew up a voting law that said African Americans, black Americans, have to take a different literacy test than white Americans, and it's harder, that was prohibited. But if a man working for the Mississippi State Elections Board happened to give a black American a much harder passage to read to prove literacy than a white American, that wasn't protected. That was individual action. And if a hotel decided not to allow black Americans to get a room in the hotel, that was individual action, not state action. So the prohibitions, the intent of the amendment was to guarantee that all Americans of whatever color received the same treatment under the law. But little by little, the court chipped away at that. And by the mid-1880s, the 14th Amendment, for all intents and purposes, didn't apply to black Americans. And then, which is even a bigger irony, as the corporate class, because it was a huge burgeoning of industrial power in the country, as the corporate class was looking for protection against minimum wage laws, against regulation of prices, the court spun around and said that the 14th Amendment provides those very protections against state, against the action of an individual state, those very protections to a corporation that had denied Black Americans. So I think if you look at the record, it's pretty clear that we had an amendment passed to protect 4 million newly freed Americans, and the court was the main actor in preventing that from happening. And then they turned around and said, but okay, but corporations, they need protection. So it's really difficult to look and say, this is a fair application of America's legal system. What you really get is the court can call the Constitution anything it wants to call it, and they can find some precedent to support it, which they did, and which I think they do today.
You seem to be saying that the Supreme Court neutralized the 14th Amendment in terms of its protections for real people, Black people in the South, and then expanded the amendment to cover corporate people, people who are not flesh and blood human beings, everywhere in the country.
Neutralize is exactly the right word. In fact, I there's a line I wrote in the book, the court having now decided that the 14th Amendment protects inanimate objects. But yes, that's precisely right, and that's the right word. And the court did this, let's understand, the American population, the populace, the white population of America was none too pleased in the North or the South at having all of a sudden to share its hotel rooms, its theater seats, its railroad cars with Black Americans. When the court overturned the Civil Rights Act of 1875 and 1883, when they called it unconstitutional, editorials all over the country praised the court for finally bringing back the right spirit of America, that the federal government shouldn't be imposing its will on states and on individual people. So what the court did was highly popular. It just happened to be wrong.
And you also seem to be saying, and I think this is at the heart of your book, that the U.S. Supreme Court, after the Civil War, didn't just okay or rubber stamp the Jim Crow initiatives from the South and elsewhere, but was actually a kind of political, ideological engine for Jim Crow.
I think that's a fair statement. And I would say the word I would use is enabler. They didn't pass the laws, and they didn't approve of the laws, or at least they didn't say so, nor did they disapprove. But what they did was create a framework by which every southern state from 1890 on, Mississippi did it first, they changed their constitution in 1890, and every southern state changed its constitution after that to, as long as you didn't announce that you were discriminating in your constitution, you were free of 14th Amendment prohibitions. So what these states did was they avoided announcing that they would discriminate, but they created an atmosphere within which they could discriminate. So yes, and the justices are not blind. It is hard to believe that they were sitting and watching all of this happen, and with lynchings and beatings and disenfranchisement. There were, in Louisiana, before they changed their constitution, there were 160,000 Black voters. After, about 10 years later, maybe less, there was 1,600 Black voters.
This doesn't sound like a wink and a nod from the Supreme Court justices. This sounds like a bring it on.
Well, I don't know that you can go that far, although I'm sure, a wink and a nod, I don't think that's necessarily right either. I think they weren't part of it. They're sitting in Washington. I think that it's turning your back. In fact, I used four quotes at the beginning of the book, and one of them is Oliver Wendell Holmes, and then there are a couple. But the last one I have is from Bob Dylan. How many times can a man turn his head and pretend that he just doesn't see? and they didn't see. There was one case I discuss in the book, which was involved a terrible massacre in which 200 African Americans, part of the Louisiana militia, actual officials of the Louisiana government, were slaughtered by a mob of whites. And three people eventually were convicted, and the court overturned the conviction. So, whether they were sitting back and saying this is a good thing, when the Constitution was drawn up, and when there was a very serious debate over ratification, New York was a state that was very, very close to not accepting the Constitution. So Alexander Hamilton and two other people wrote the Federalist Papers. Now, these are very famous documents as in political theory, but really what they were a series of op-ed pieces. They were spin pieces. They were ads trying to persuade the people of New York to vote for the Constitution, which they actually didn't want. And Hamilton said, because there was real fear about the court system, and Hamilton said, the court system is going to be the protector of the people. That the court system was going to be the place where individual citizens would be able to ensure that they were not oppressed by their government. Well, of course, this turned out to be completely not the case. So what you have in the court, I don't want to stretch it so far as to say that the court actively participated, but certainly they passively participated, and certainly they knowingly participated. So we have a situation here where there was, if not political corruption, certainly moral corruption.
And in the Louisiana case that you talked about, that particular massacre, that didn't involve just a white mob. That was a white army that was on the march. And Louisiana was in a kind of situation that looked much like an El Salvador or some other Central American country. But let's get to the framers of the Constitution. You know, it was only a couple of weeks ago that the Republicans, in a bit of political theater, read the whole Constitution out loud. It was, of course, including the amendments. It wasn't the original Constitution, and the Republicans came under some criticism for that, since they're always talking about original intent. The original Constitution, of course, specifically safeguarded slavery from any challenge for the first 20 years of its life.
That was the slave trade. They protected the slave trade. Slave economics and the slave trade. I wrote a book on this called Dark Bargain, which shows just how many of the clauses of the Constitution were actually drawn up specifically because of slave economics. For example, the census, which people don't think about, but everyone expected the population of the country to move south and that the slave states would have more, so there was a big debate over the census. The original intent of the framers was that in order to have a country, you had to support the slave system. But the slave system was very, very different in Virginia, say, than it was in South Carolina. In Virginia, there were actually more slaves than there were whites when the Constitution was drawn up. And they were terrified of slave revolts because Virginia is nice countryside. They were growing tobacco, a nice open crop, where in South Carolina, slaves were in rice paddies, and they died at an alarming rate. So what Virginia wanted to do was to sell its excess slaves to South Carolina at a very inflated price. South Carolina said, no, we would rather import them from Africa. So the South Carolinians and the Georgians got together with the New Englanders, the shippers, and that's where that 20-year extension of the slave trade came from. The Virginians hated it and voted against it, and a couple of Virginians refused to sign the Constitution because they couldn't sell their excess slaves to South Carolina. So that's another really interesting little story that most Americans don't know.
So the Virginian slave owners wanted to protect the internal slave trade and therefore opposed the external slave trade.
Precisely. Because it was much cheaper, Because remember, if you're a Virginian and you're selling a male slave at 14 years old, you had 14 years that you had to pay to have to feed, provide basic medical care because you can't sell a bad asset. Whereas importing from Africa, the conditions were well known to be utterly horrific. And the New England shippers, who made most of the money, who were doing the shipping, just packed as many Africans as they could into these ships. So if you were in South Carolina and you needed new male slaves all the time because in the rice paddies there was disease and heat and snakes and all sorts of stuff, you wanted the cheapest place you could get them, and that was imports. So you had a compromise at the end of August in the Constitutional Convention where two Connecticut delegates and John Rutledge from South Carolina, who was the most unapologetic defender of slavery at the Constitutional Convention, actually got together and came up with this compromise. The Northerners got commerce free. The Northerners got assurances that there would not be regulation of commerce. And the Southerners, the lower South, got assurances that the slave trade would continue uninterrupted. If one reads the records of the Constitutional Convention, which the people who read the Constitution rarely do, by the way, this becomes very clear.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you BlackAgendaReport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my colleague, Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.